Judges chapter 7. This, you might call this message Gideon part 2. Not that we ever title them, but to keep you in mind of where we are at, the Lord has chosen a guy named Gideon to head up the deliverance of Israel from the Midianites. The Midianites were getting together in coalition with some other God-hating, Israeli-hating peoples, and they would swoop down upon the Israelites' land and basically wipe out their crops and take everything and kill their livestock or steal it. And so Israel was reduced to living in famine in the caves. And so there was a guy named Gideon trying to thresh wheat in the wine press, and the Lord appears and says, "Hey, Gideon, you're the guy. You're gonna deliver my people from the hand of the Midianites. But the first thing I want you to do is I want you to go up to your father's idolatrous Baal altar there, and I want you to tear it down. And this is how we're going to set up your leadership here. This is how we're going to start this. By getting rid, before we can get rid of Israel's enemies, we have to get Israel right with God." And so he was a little afraid to do that, so he did it at night with some guys and tore it down. And when the townspeople woke up in the morning and saw their altar to Baal, and or their, his father's altar to Baal, wiped out, they were going to wipe him out. They decided that that was worthy of being put to death, and his dad jumped in. Now remember, his dad was a Baal worshiper, but his dad jumped in and said, "Hey, wait a second, Baal isn't such a wimp. If he's really a god, then he doesn't need you to protect him. And so let Baal contend with him. You don't need to defend him. That if Baal's a real god, he'll just jump in there and take care of it." And so Gideon picks up this nickname, Yerubbaal, which means let Baal contend. And so when you read about Yerubbaal, that's Gideon, and that will reference that about a dozen times in the scriptures, his being called Yerubbaal, let Baal contend. So the Midianites, along with their allies, have assembled together to wipe out Israel. Gideon gets together, sounds a trumpet, and the Abiezerites, which is Gideon's clan and the tribe of Manasseh, he was from the... Remember how all of Israel was divided into 12 tribes, and those tribes each had families. Well, Abiezer was one of the guys in Manasseh, and so the Abiezerites was Gideon's big old family clan kind of thing. They gather together with Gideon when he sounds the trumpet, and the Israeli army begins to get bigger and bigger as more warriors from Manasseh and Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali, they join with Gideon. And so we see that Gideon's got 32,000 men now ready to go up against the Midianites and their innumerable allies here. And as we pick up in chapter 7, we see, "Then Yerubbaal," that is Gideon, "and all the people who were with him rose early and camped beside the spring of Herod. And the camp of Midian was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into your hands.'" Too many. "Lest Israel become boastful, saying, 'My own power has delivered me.' Now therefore come, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, 'Whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilgal, or from Mount Gilead.'" So 22,000 returned, but 10,000 remained. "Hey, if anybody's scared, if anybody's knees are knocking, you can go." And two out of every three people get up and leave. Oh boy. "Then the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many. The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water and I will test them for you there. Therefore, it shall be that he of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, he shall go with you. But of everyone whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go.' So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, 'You shall separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink.' Now the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men, but all the rest of the people kneeled to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, 'I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped, and I will give the Midianites into your hands. So let all the other people go, each man to his home.' So the 300 men took the people's provisions and their trumpets into their hands. And Gideon sent all the other men of Israel, each to his tent, but retained the 300 men. And the camp of Midian was below him in the valley." Gideon's army, 32,000 men camped out beside this spring of Herod or Harod. And the Lord says, there's too many of you. There's too many of you. I don't want to use this many of you. Because if you guys win, or when you guys win, you're going to say, hey, we're pretty good. Those were pretty tough odds, you know. It was like 4-1, 5-1. I forget the total number here. But they were innumerable, and there's 32,000 of them. No, you guys actually have a chance. And I don't like to give you a victory when you actually have a chance. Because you'll take the credit for it. So the Lord instituted Deuteronomy 20, which had said, basically, if anyone was afraid to go home in the army, they should go home. Deuteronomy 20 says, when you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, don't be afraid of them. For the Lord your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt is with you. In verse 8 it says, then the officers shall speak further to the people, and they shall say, who is the man that is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house, so that he might not make his brothers' hearts melt like his heart. Fear is very contagious. Fear is very contagious, and God knew that. And he would rather have a smaller army of people whose knees weren't knocking than to have some of those guys sprinkled in that were afraid. And, you know, in the tents at night, they'd go, oh, man, I don't think we're going to make it. And then, of course, the guy who hears that goes, yeah, maybe we're not going to make it. Hey, do you think we're going to? Oh, we're all scared now. So it's like a disease. Fear is like a disease that we don't want among us. You know, it's like, man, go home. It's better if you go home. And when he gave them this opportunity, 22,000 of them left. More than two-thirds of them said, yeah, I'm afraid. Yeah, I'd really rather go home. Wow, that's might as well send them home. There's really no use for a fearful man in war. But when they had 10,000 left, God said, no, this is still too many. This is still too many. You might boast. You still might have a miraculous chance in and of your own ability to say, yeah, we did it. We're powerful. We didn't need the Lord. And, you know, a lot of us are guilty of that. A lot of us, you know, we pray and we go, oh, Lord, deliver me from this trial. Oh, thanks, God. The check already came, so it's all taken care of. And he's going, you dummy, I sent the check. But a lot of times we take credit, or we say, oh, God, everything worked out okay. You don't need to worry about it, when he's actually been the one to do it. So God gets it down to the ridiculous now. God says, I want you to go down to the water. I want you to go down to the spring and watch how the guys drink. And it's interesting how he did it. It sounds to me, at first reading, like if you got on your hands and knees and drank the water, that would be lapping like a dog. But there's actually a description here. The word lapping in Hebrew sounds exactly, when you say it, it sounds exactly like when a dog drinks the water. If you've ever seen slow motion video of a dog drinking the water, his tongue actually goes into the water and kind of forms a cup real quick and it throws it into his mouth is basically what he's doing. Well, these guys who were lapping like dogs were really down on one knee, holding their spears or their swords, reaching into the water and basically throwing the water up into their mouth and making that sound. And so that was the lapping like dogs. The other guys, man, they put their spears down. They're thirsty. They've been marching all the way down here. They get on their hands and knees and start slurping it out of the spring. God didn't want to use them either. He sent them all home. The guys that were through the water lapped it into their mouth like dogs. There was only 300 of them. God said, I want to use those 300. Notice the two things that he weeded out. Number one, he didn't want people that were fearful of the enemy. And number two, he wanted people that were watchful of their enemy. You see, as a soldier, I mean, what would happen if these guys started running up the hill? The Midianite camp started running up at them and attacking them, and here they are on all fours drinking the water out of the... That's no good. He wanted them watchful. He didn't want them fearful of the enemy, but he did want them watchful of the enemy. And that's how God very often will divide up. You know, the church, on any given Sunday, there's probably 150 people here. But not all of them are being used mightily in ministry. Only a small percentage of them are being used. And I believe that one way that we can disqualify ourselves is if we're fearful of our enemy. Who's our enemy? The devil, of course. But he can also disqualify us if we're not being watchful. See, the two biggest mistakes I think you can make in relation to the devil is, number one, to give him too much power, and number two, to assume that he's powerless. See, both things are a mistake. if we live in fear of the devil, man, we are crippled. But if we sit there going, oh, yeah, he doesn't do anything, then we're deceived. Now, Peter tells us in 1 Peter 5, 8 and 9, that we needn't be fearful of him, but we need to always be watchful regarding him. He says, be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour, but resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. Yet, the devil is like a roaring lion. Yes, he is seeking people to devour, and you need to be watchful of that, but you don't need to be fearful of him. You need to resist him and stand strong against your enemy. Resist the devil and he will flee from you, the scripture tells us. So, we need to have that balance in regard to our enemy, not being fearful, but definitely being watchful. And people who walk in a manner like that are very useful to God, even if there's only 300 of them. And so we see in verse 9 that after he sent everybody home, there's 300 of them. And he says, the same night, it came about that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hands. Now, at that point, I think that Gideon's knees were probably making just as much noise as the other guys that had already been sent home. I think it probably had flashed through Gideon's mind, man, why didn't you give me the opportunity to go? I would have gone with the 22,000. He was freaked out, especially now just being with 300 guys. So the Lord says, but if you are afraid to go down, go with Purah, your servant, down to the camp, and you will hear what they say. And afterward, your hands will be strengthened that you may go down against the camp. If you're afraid, go down with Purah. So he went with Purah, his servant, down to the outposts of the army that was in the camp. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. You get the idea, there's a lot of these guys. And he said, so there's two guys here talking. He said, behold, I had a dream. A loaf of barley bread was tumbling into the camp of Midian. And it came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. And his friend answered and said, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand. And it came about when Gideon heard the account of the dream and its interpretation that he bowed in worship. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands. Gideon, if you're afraid, that's okay. Take Purah and go down, your servant, go down and I'll give you something that help you gather your courage. He goes down on their spine and there's these two guys are probably on watch. It says everybody else was lying down. They were all asleep. These two guys, I had the weirdest dream right before watch. You know, I dreamed that like we're here in this valley and this loaf of barley bread came rolling down and it hit the tent. The tent flipped upside down and lay flat. And the other guy went, oh, man, that means we're going to lose. God had given the dream. God had given the dream's interpretation. And when Gideon heard that, he gathered strength. He gathered courage, and he went back and he told the guys, "Oh, the Lord's done this." Gideon was a guy who didn't walk in a lot of faith, although Hebrews 11 does, believe it or not, list him as a man of faith, who walked more in the confirmation of things. You know, he was the guy that set out the fleece twice. You know, he's like, "Hey, I need some signs here." You know, Gideon was a guy that needed some visual confirmation of what God had spoken into his heart. And God knew that, and he allowed him to do that. God was merciful to him, not sending him home with the other guys whose knees were knocking, but said, you'll hear this dream. When he heard the dream, he's like, okay, yes. Now, this is an interesting thing that he's described as a loaf of barley bread. Barley bread was the bread of poor people. It was the bread it was probably the only bread they had available to them in the famine. And Gideon doesn't take offense and goes, hey, God, why didn't you make me a stone rolling in there, smashing everybody flat, you know? And he's like, man, he just worships. And so I like that too, the fact that he bowed low in worship. And then he mustered his whole huge army of 300 guys here. In verse 16 says, "And he divided the 300 men into three companies. And he put trumpets and empty pitchers into the hand of all of them." These aren't frames with no pitchers in them. These are not pictures. They're pitchers. And he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. And behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you also blow the trumpets all around the camp and say, 'For the Lord and for Gideon.'" So Gideon and the 100 men who are with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, when they had just posted the watch. And they blew the trumpets and smashed the pitchers that were in their hands. When the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing, and cried, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon!" And each stood in his place around the camp. And all the army ran, crying out as they fled. And when they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against another, even throughout the whole army. And the army fled as far as Beth Hashitah toward Tzera, not that you ever need to know these things, as far as the edge of Abel Meholah by Tabath. That's exciting. 300 guys, divvies them up into groups of 100 each. So there's these three companies of 100. Each one of them is given a trumpet, a pitcher, like an earthenware vessel of to hold water in, and they turned it upside down and put a torch in it. And so they gathered around the mountains around the valley where the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were gathered. And he goes, "Okay, do what I do." And they smashed those pitchers, and as the oxygen probably made those torches glow even brighter, and held those things up and blew the trumpets and shouted, "The sword of the Lord, sword," you know what they shouted, "For the Lord and for Gideon." "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." The Midianites wake up to this racket. They've been sleeping. It's the second watch. It's the middle of the night. It's like 3 a.m, I think it was. And they wake up and they see 300 torches. Now, in those days, according to historians, one torch would lead 1,000 men. And so they see 300 torches. Oh, man, we're bummed. And they hear the trumpets blowing, and oh, no. And they were so freaked out and so disoriented that they began to fight one another. Oh, it's in the dark. They're swinging at anything that moves. And they become victorious. The army starts hacking at each other and runs away. Now, there's a picture here that I don't think we should miss, because it's important where this becomes beyond a history lesson and becomes applicable to our own hearts. They broke these pitchers, these earthenware vessels, to expose the light to defeat the enemy. Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, he said, "God, who said, 'Light shall shine out of darkness,' is the one who has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the surpassing greatness of the power may be of God and not from ourselves." Paul's talking about a treasure. The treasure is called the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. We have in these bodies the light of the knowledge of the glory of God. We've been exposed. The Holy Spirit has come and dwelt inside of us. We've been exposed to the glory of God, and we have knowledge of that. And that knowledge is light. It's the light that we are to shine, not to put under a basket, but to shine. But see, that light that's in us is just like the light that Gideon's army had. It was hidden in an earthen vessel. Now, what had to be done to that earthen vessel to shine that light and defeat the enemy? It had to be broken. That earthenware vessel had to be broken to expose the light. And it's the same for us, because we have this light in earthen vessels as well. David wrote in Psalm 51, he said, "O Lord, open my lips, that my mouth may declare thy praise, for thou dost not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I would give it. Thou art not pleased with burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. Oh, God, Thou wilt not despise. The Lord's desire for us, more than His desire for the Jews to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings, His desire for us is for our hearts and our spirits to continually be broken and contrite. Remember when Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Blessed are the poor in spirit. It's the same thing. It's that He desires us to be broken because we need to be broken to expose that light. Maybe the word contrite is not a word that you use in everyday language. If you look that word up in the Hebrew, you see it comes from a root word that means crushed, broken to bits, broken to pieces. And so contrite, it means to be smashed into pieces, a broken and smashed into pieces heart. Oh God, Thou wilt not despise. And that's the sacrifice that God desires. And so when Gideon's army shined their light, when they broke those earthen vessels and shined their light, their enemy was defeated. And they didn't even, at that point, they didn't even need to do hand-to-hand combat. They were shining the light and the enemy was all freaked out and fighting one another. Each of us that has been born again has the light of the knowledge of the glory of God inside of us. And if we really desire to shine that light and knock down those gates of hell and drag people out of hell and have their citizenship transferred into the kingdom of God's beloved Son, we need to do that by allowing ourselves to be broken. God cannot and will not use a man who is not broken or a woman who is not broken. And that light, oh, it may be shining out through cracks, but essentially, if we don't allow God to break us, we are hiding our light under a bushel, under a basket. And God's desire is that we would set it up on a hill. Well, if it's going to shine like that, we need to allow ourselves to be broken. Verse 23 says that the men of Israel were summoned from Naphtali and Asher and all Manasseh, and they pursued Midian. And Gideon sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against Midian and take the waters before them, as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan." So all the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they took the waters as far as Beth Barah and the Jordan. And they captured the two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. And they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and they killed Zeeb at the winepress of Zeeb. That's probably why they were named these things, I'm guessing. While they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon from across the Jordan. So, only 300 guys were used at first, but when the army took off running, Gideon gathered everybody together again and said, "Hey guys, let's chase him down to Beth Barah. You know, let's get people from Naphtali, Asher, Manasseh, Ephraim. Let's run these guys out of town all the way to the Jordan River. Let's get them out of here so they won't be a thorn in our side anymore." They catch guys from Ephraim, catch and kill the two Midianite commanders. Now, these presumably were the two highest up, you might call them generals or whatever. They weren't the kings because the two kings are coming next. But these were like the two generals. Apparently, the Midianites were under two kings and had two specific high commanding guys, Oreb and Zeeb. They catch them, they kill them, they cut off their heads, they bring these heads back to Gideon. And chapter 8, verse 1 says, "Then the men of Ephraim said to him, 'What is this thing you have done to us, not calling us when you went to fight against Midian?' And they contended with him vigorously. But he said to them, 'What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has given you the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb, into your hands, and what was I able to do in comparison with you?' Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that." Now, the men of Ephraim were offended that Gideon hadn't invited them to the first battle, you know. Remember, Gideon had more than enough guys there. Gideon had guys from Asher and Manasseh and at least one or two other tribes there. They didn't need the Ephraimites. They needed less guys. God was saying, "No, I want you to get rid of these. You know, I want you to get rid of 29,900 guys. I only want you." That's probably wrong. 31,000, somebody help me, 31,700 guys. I want you to get rid of these guys. You know, I don't want more. And Ephraim, or Gideon actually hadn't called most of the other tribes either. You know, he'd called three or four, but there was 12 tribes. He hadn't called them either. And Ephraim basically was just looking for something to complain about. Now, maybe they were genuinely offended, but as you look at the history of Ephraim and Manasseh, the tribe that Gideon's from, they were always bugging each other. They were always, you know, they had like this sibling rivalry thing going where they're always complaining to mom kind of thing. You know, they're always picking fights with one another. And if you remember the beginning of this back in Genesis 48, Ephraim and Manasseh were the two sons that, the two sons of Joseph that when Joseph brought these two kids in to have their grandfather, Jacob, also known as Israel, speak a blessing over them, that he switched hands, you know, the right hand on the youngest and the left hand on the oldest. And, you know, Joseph's like, hey, Dad, I know you're old and stuff, but you got it mixed up. And he's going, no, I want it this way. And so he gave the blessing of the firstborn to the youngest one, and he gave the youngest one's blessing to the firstborn. And so it was a real slight, and Ephraim and Manasseh had never really recovered from that. We read in Isaiah, apparently there had been rivalry and contention between them and their descendants all the way through. Isaiah 9, chapter 21 says, Manasseh devours Ephraim, and Ephraim Manasseh, and together they are against Judah. So it seemed that they had this history of contention and strife, Gideon's tribe Manasseh and the Ephraimites who cut off the heads of Oreb and Zeeb. And so Gideon could have bought into this argument and could have said, oh yeah, well, you know, this and that and this and that. But he applies this proverb, and a proverb which hadn't even been written yet. So you see some wisdom here. Proverbs 15:1, it's been written for us. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. It's amazing. When somebody's going ballistic on you, it's amazing the power that you have in your hand to either throw gas on that fire or put out that fire just with your words. When somebody's contending with you, be it with your husband or your wife or your neighbor or whatever, it's amazing how a gentle answer can turn away wrath. And it's neat when you can apply this. I would give you examples, but I'm usually the one stirring up wrath, so it would only make me look bad. A gentle answer, turning away wrath. Gideon applies this proverb that has not been written yet and says basically, oh man, you know, all I did was break some pitchers and hold up some torches, you know. I mean, look at you cut off the heads of Oreb and Zeeb. I mean, what have I done compared to what you've done? You know, you guys are awesome, man. You're cool. You're the best. And they're like, okay, sounds good to us, you know. And so it says that then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. So he turned their wrath away with a gentle answer instead of picking a fight and making it worse. Verse 4. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over, weary yet pursuing. And he said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary. And I am pursuing Zebach and Salmunah, the kings of Midian. And the leaders of Succoth said, Are the hands of Zebach and Salmunah already in your hands that we should give you bread to your army? And Gideon said, all right, when the Lord has given Zebach and Salmunah into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Verse 8, and he went up from there to Penuel and spoke similarly to them. And the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, when I return safely, I will tear down this tower. So Gideon's guys, now Gideon's bunch of 300 men, are going out after these two kings of Midian now. They're going after the head honchos, Zebach and Salmunah. And when they get to Succoth, they say, hey man, we need some supplies. And the guy said,
man, we don't want to side with a losing team. You know, from what I hear, there's like tens of thousands of them where you're going, and it looks like you've got 301. If we supply your army, it's just going to come down bad on us. I mean, you haven't already got them, so we'd just as soon stay out of it. He was expecting some camaraderie. These were Israelites. I think the tribe of Gad was living down there in Sukkoth. He was expecting some patriotism, not treason. He was expecting some support, you know, some brotherly love here. And I think, I may be wrong, I don't have a lot of respect for Gideon as I've studied the three chapters that he is the central focus of. There's not a lot about him to go, oh, what a great guy, what a godly man, and you'll see. I think that this is the beginning of his downfall, where he gets angry at his brothers and never really recovers from this. And so he goes, I'm going to thrash you guys when I come back. Man, I'm going to get these thorn bush briars and stuff. Man, I'm going to beat you to death with them. So he goes to Penuel, and he probably has a chip on his shoulder. He says, hey, guys, we need some bread. And the guys at Penuel say the same thing. He goes, I'm going to tear down this tower, and then I'm going to kill all of you. And so he goes out, and of course, he's victorious because the Lord has promised to give them the victory here. In verse 10, it says, now, Zebach and Zalmunah were in Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the entire army of the sons of the east, for the fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. And Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in the tents on the east of Nobah and Jokbeha, and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. When Zebach and Zalmunah fled, he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zebach and Zalmunah, and routed the whole army. I got to tell you, when God was dictating his word to Samuel or whoever was writing this, I think he's picturing, I can't wait to hear pastors have to say this over and over and over. It's really funny. So basically, they get to Zebach and Zalmunah, get to Karkor with their 15,000 troops, and here comes 301 guys, but they sneak up on them by night, and again, God gives them the victory. You know, when God's on your side, 300 versus 15,000, those are good odds. So they attack the unsuspecting enemy, they're victorious, they capture these two guys, rout the whole army. Now, they're not dead yet, they catch them. Verse 13, then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres. I guess you could say Heres if you want, Heres. And he captured a youth from Sukkot and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Sukkot and its elders, 77 men. And he came to the men of Sukkot and said, behold, Zebach and Zalmunah, concerning whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zebach and Zalmunah already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are weary? And he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and he disciplined the men of Sukkot with them, and he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. So when they get back to Sukkot, he's got the two kings, and he's going, neener, 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 I got them, now you're in trouble, kind of thing. And thrashes on him, and thrashes on the men of Penuel. And, you know, a lot of Bible commentators say, well, this was justifiable punishment for treason, you know, and other ones say, you know, Gideon was just living in a rough age and a rough time and whatever. But I see that this bitterness and this basically, there's some unforgiveness here, and there's just a real kind of bitter spirit about him. It never leaves him, and you'll see as we go through the rest of chapter 8 that Gideon never really recovers from this. Verse 18, then he said to Zebach and Zalmunah, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? And they said, oh, they were like you, each one resembling the son of a king. And he said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother, as the Lord lives. If only you had let them live, I would not kill you. So he said to Yether, his firstborn, rise, kill them. But the youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. Then Zebach and Zalmunah said, rise up yourself and fall on us, for as the man is, so is his strength. So Gideon arose and killed Zebah and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks. Gideon turns his attention to these two kings of Midian and finds out, okay, I've heard rumors that my brothers were killed by you two directly. Is this true? What did they look like? What did these guys that you killed look like? Well, yeah, they dressed like you, you know, same kind of outfit or whatever. Those were my brothers. If you had let them live, I'd let you live. So he turns to his oldest son. What was his name? Yether. Unfortunately, Yether doesn't say Yether. He says, Yether, kill him. And he says, no, Ther. Somebody write that down. That's good stuff. It says that he was a youth and he was afraid to do it because he was a youth. He was a kid. You know, you can't really tell. The word youth in Hebrew basically denotes a child, but we don't know if the kid was 6 years old or 12 years old, but he was somewhere in there, you know. And he's going, you know, Dad, I'm afraid to do it. Now, the two kings, Zebah and Zalmunna, are actually pretty relieved for two reasons. Number one, it was the ultimate disgrace to be killed by a child. I mean, you just, killed in war by a child was just like, I mean, you might as well be killed by a woman. And we talked about that before, about how disgraceful that was when the woman killed Sisera by pounding a tent peg through his head. Killed by a child was worse. It was the utter disgrace. But even more than the disgrace, you picture this, say he's 8 years old, picks up a sword, and can you imagine getting killed by an 8-year-old with a sword? Man, that's going to take a long time, and that's going to hurt. You know, an adult man can pretty much do it in one shot, but an 8-year-old, you know, he's like, Dad, I'm hitting him with it, you know, but so they say, as the man is, so is his strength, you know, he's saying, we'd rather have you kill us, get it over with quick kind of thing, you know, we don't want to be sitting here with the food processor, you know, and, sorry, that was probably gross, but if I had a choice to be killed with a sword wielded by an 8-year-old and killed by a sword wielded by Gideon, I mean, I would rather have Gideon do it. And obviously these guys did too. So less painful, more swift at the hands of a strong man. As the man, so is his strength. And so Gideon arose, killed these two guys, took the stuff, the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks. And then it says in verse 22, then the man of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Man, that sounds like good stuff. That sounds like biblical stuff. It sounds like Gideon actually might be worthy of some respect here. It's not going to last very long, unfortunately. But for the time being, Gideon, whether he knows the scriptures or whether he's being led by the Lord, he is applying what the Lord had said. Because the Lord said, you know, Israel's not supposed to be a dictatorship, and Israel's not supposed to be a democracy. Israel's supposed to be a theocracy. The name Israel actually means governed by God. They're not supposed to have a president. They're not supposed to have a king. They're not supposed to have anybody in charge except God himself. God is supposed to be directing the nation. And of course, in the time of the judges, everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. They're thinking, I mean, even they in their sin could recognize, man, we need some kind of leadership and we're not willing to submit to God. We need a king. And God, though he had forbidden it, he said, basically one day you're going to demand a king. Basically one day you're not going to live up to these rules. And when you ask for a king, what I want you to do is this. I want you to let me pick him. If you demand him, I'll let you have one, but let me pick him. And Deuteronomy 17, God gave instructions regarding this. He said, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. They were supposed to be governed by God, but if they chose not to be, God said, at least let me pick the guy who's going to rule over you. But they're not doing either thing. They're not obeying either commandment at this point. They're like, oh man, Gideon, you're the guy. You can be king, and your son can be king after you, and your grandson can be king after him, and oh, that'll work out great. But Gideon says, I'm not going to rule over you. My son's not going to rule over you. God's going to rule over you. And so that speaks well of Gideon's character, but again, downhill from here. Verse 24, there's that word yet. He said this great thing, yet Gideon said to them, I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil. They had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they said, we will surely give them. So they spread out a garment, and every one of them threw an earring there from his spoil. And the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple robes, which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on their camels' necks. And Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city, Ophrah. And all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. So Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads any more. And the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons, who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. Now, it sounds like Gideon just got paid for the battle, basically. You know, no, I don't want to be king. Let God rule over you. You know, if you each give me an earring, that'll suffice. And so they spread out a blanket, and each one of them went by and tossed an earring in there, and it turned out to be 1,700 shekels of gold, quite a bit of gold. And he melted it all down and made this ephod, which you remember that was a garment that the priest wore, and it was basically an apron, like a full apron tied on the shoulders, covering your chest and part of your back. And he made one of these out of gold. Didn't wear it, just set it up on display, apparently, in Ophrah, his hometown. And he puts it up on display, and maybe even his heart, not to give Gideon too hard of a time, maybe his heart was, this will be a reminder. You know, I formed it in the shape of an ephod, which is a priestly kind of thing. It's made out of the gold from the spoil of this whole battle against the Midianites and these guys. So maybe it'll be a reminder to everybody. Oh, yeah, remember when God did this great thing. But in reality, what it turned out to be is it turned out to be an idol that it says the sons of Israel actually played the harlot with this. In other words, they turned it into an idol, and they started to worship this thing, and they started to, you know, burn incense to it or whatever, and they started to glorify Gideon. Oh, Gideon, this great guy really should be king. Sure, you don't want to be king, Gideon? You know, no, I'd rather have multiple wives, you know. And it turned into this big pride thing for Gideon, that as long as this thing was on display, people were building them up. And as long as people were building them up, man, he was getting puffed up. And by the time Gideon got to be old, he had 70 sons because he had a bunch of wives, which kings were forbidden to do. So, you know, if he had taken on the kingship, that would have been sin. He had wives, he had concubines. One of his concubines, who was in Shechem, bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. Now, that might not sound like any worse than the fact that, hey, he had a concubine. That's not a good thing. But he named him Abimelech. Abimelech in Hebrew means, my father is king. That's what Gideon named his kid. My father is king. That's a pretty sad statement. It gives us an insight into Gideon's heart at this time. And so he's got all these wives, concubines, names his son, one of his sons, my father is king. Verse 32, and Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a ripe old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophrah of the Abiezerites. Then it came about, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the household of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel. Once again, this cycle goes around again, and as I said, the book of Judges is basically this wheel that turns seven times of what I'm calling the cycle of sin, where the people are doing okay with God, but then they fall into sin and idolatry, and God sells them into slavery, and then they are in slavery for a while. They cry out to God. God raises up a judge, delivers them. They go, oh, praise God. And then they do it right around again. And chapter 2 basically gave us an outline of this, but in verse 19 it said, it would come about when the judge died that they would turn back and act more corruptly than their fathers in following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not abandon their practices or their stubborn ways. So it seems to be a cycle that gets worse and more degenerated with every time. It's more like a downward spiral maybe than a wheel that's turning. As soon as Gideon dies, Israel begins to worship a god of the Philistine, Baal-berith, and Abimelech. We're going to see as we get into chapter 9 next week that this is a bad guy. He ends up having his other brother killed, you know, saying, hey, why should you have 70 kings when you could just have me, you know? And so there's some bad stuff that things seem to go from bad to worse for Gideon's family. And as we examine Gideon's life, though, again, if you're listed in Hebrews 11, you can't be all bad, right? Gideon was available for the Lord to use him, but if we look at the negative things of his life, these things were written as examples for us, as lessons for us. And God might call us if we're available to him, but we need to look at where Gideon went wrong and avoid that for ourselves. If God calls you to something, don't be putting out a fleece, and then he answers, and then put out another fleece. And if he calls you into battle, don't be going, oh man, Lord, I'm afraid. Can you give me some kind of sign, some kind of confirmation? That's the opposite of what the Apostle Paul said. Paul said, we walk by faith, not by sight. So we need to begin to walk by faith and not by sight. We need to trust God when he tells us something. We need to trust that. We need to trust him. We need to not become so bitter when our brothers and sisters let us down. I mean, how many of us have been raked over the coals by someone we went to church with or someone at work who's a Christian or, you know, and we never recover from that. We just walk in such bitterness and we never recover to the place where God can use us. We never get over that. We need to get over it. We need to pluck out the root of bitterness because that bitterness defiles many. And many were defiled by Gideon and his, basically this ephod. We need to be aware of selfishness. If God does something, we can't sit there and go, yeah, you could give me some money, you know, kind of thing. Yeah, you could give me some of the credit. You can make me rich because God used me. And we need to be careful of when people say, oh man, God just used you so much. You really ministered to me when you showed me that love. Or man, I walked into church and I was really bummed and you reached out to me. Oh, thanks for letting God use you and stuff. And we start to think, hey, I'm super saint. We need to be careful of that too. So there's all these things that were stumbling blocks to Gideon that are examples for us to avoid. Let's go to the Lord in prayer.